This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Jack Horan. Jack is a partner at McKenna, Long & Aldridge, LLP, here in Washington, D.C., and Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger.
Right. And Jack, I know before we get started, I know today we're going to do a lot of talking about GAO bid protests, trends, statistics, and that sort of thing. But I thought I'd give you an opportunity to introduce yourself to the listening audience.
Thank you, Roger. As you mentioned, I'm a partner at McKenna, Long & Aldridge. I've been practicing government contracts law for about 25 years now, I hate to admit. That's since I graduated law school, except
that's why you don't have any hair.
That's right.
I'm rapidly approaching your look.
and I have a face for radio. Except for a few years where I practiced criminal law as an assistant United States attorney here in D.C., I focused my practice in government contracts and both litigation and compliance.
I would like to ask guests sometimes, like, well, how did you... Was it a matter of your legal education? How did you get involved in government contracts that to make it your career field, your expertise?
Yep, somewhat of an indirect way, Roger. I was in law school here in Washington, D.C. I needed a job to pay for the tuition and got a winter law clerk position at small firm that did primarily government contracts at the time, Pettit & Martin,
which no longer exists. So it was love at first crack of the book there, or what?
It was. I like most kids in law school, I had no idea what government contracts was.
Yep.
And when I started practicing, I realized that it's really a bunch of practices combined into one, and what the common theme of those practices is that the government's on the other side if you're representing contractors, but there's employment law issues, there's tons of litigation, there's counseling. Just about every area you can think about is contained within government contracts.
I mean, that's a great point, you know, from intellectual property rights, there's social policy issues, small business, that sort of thing, economic policy issues. You know, there's basic contracts and disputes, and like you say. And to me, the other aspect that I always, found interesting or drew me to government contracts was that it touches everything the government does. You know, it's not, you know, you learn about, you know, just working on contracts and transactions, you learn a heck of a lot about programs that the government's, managing on behalf of the citizens, that sort of thing. It's really a very fascinating area.
It is. And it goes as, and really what led me to the U.S. Attorney's Office, which is was a purely criminal practice, was the fact that civil fraud and criminal has its role in government contracts as well. We hate when we get to that overlap, but it's been there for 20, 25 years.
Yeah. Well, today, Jack, we're going to talk about, one of those fascinating areas to us, government contracts geeks, and maybe to the rest of the world, a little they scratch their head, but we're going to talk GAO bid protests. And particularly, we're going to, start, and this is kind of interesting. A lawyer is going to talk numbers and statistics, but we'll give it a shot, right? But we're going to talk a little bit about GAO statistics on bid protests, and there's a couple sets of documents you're going to talk about.
Yeah, that's right, Roger. I thought, let me take a step back. I guess bid protests I find interesting, keeping with the theme of interesting government contracts practices, because of the litigation aspect of it. As you know, it's a process by which a offeror can challenge the government's decision to award a contract to a competitor, and that's uniquely government. If you lose in the commercial world, there's not much you can do to challenge the award to a competitor. I advise clients on that often, and one part of the advice and one part of the consideration for the client is whether a bid protest is worth the effort and the expense for the offeror. And I found the government puts out some statistics. I'm going to talk about two sets that it's very helpful to put the likelihood of success of a protest in the context of what's happened in the past. There are two sets of statistics I'm going to talk about a bit to provide that context. And the first set is based on a report by the Government Accountability Office, issued by the Managing Associate General Counsel there, where GAO reports on the results of its protests for the prior year. And the second is a study done or an analysis done by Dan Gordon, who I'm sure you're familiar with, anyone in our industry is, about it's about a number of things, but one focus of interest of his analysis focuses on the likelihood that a protester is ultimately successful in winning the contest after the protest. Winning the contract after the protest.
Okay, and with Dan's analysis, is there an underlying sort of thesis that these protests aren't disruptive, or are they? Is that kind of thing? He's taking that approach.
Yeah, there's a discussion generally as to whether protests are overly disruptive to the procurement process, and there's a procedural structure to protest that is designed to limit the effect on the actual procurement. Dan was looking at it from a number of different angles and ultimately concluded that the protest forum is very valuable for the procurement process and ultimately not all that obstructive.
Okay, so. And I think in addition to statistics, we're going to talk about anything else today?
Yeah, there are a few cases that I think are particularly important for GSA and VA schedule holders, and I'd like to discuss those.
Absolutely. That'd be great. That'd be great. But let's start with the stats first. And, where are we with what do the GAO statistics tell us right now?
Yeah, a couple things I think of general interest for government contractors. First is that bid protests have increased regularly from 2008 through 2012, the year of the most recent statistics. Based on how the GAO counts bid protests, it had 1,652 in 2008 and 2,475 in 2012. So that's an increase of, if I'm doing the math right, and this is always dangerous for me.
Yeah. You're a lawyer. That's okay.
Yeah, that's right. That's an increase of about 5% a year, and I think a total increase of about 30 or 40% during the period.
Okay. Wow. With regard to that, how many of these get resolved either through, because most, I guess, don't actually go to actual decision? What happens? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, a couple things can happen after a protest is filed. And again, just for clarity, a protest is when can happen at two times, one of two times. One is if a offeror thinks a solicitation is unfair or is improper in some way, they can file what's called a protest against the solicitation, asking the GAO to take a look at the solicitation to assure that it complies with statute and regulation. And the second type of protest, which is more common and which I referred to previously, is a protest against the award. And there, a unsuccessful offeror can protest the agency's decision to award a contract to a competitor. As I said, in 2012, there were about 2,500 cases, protests filed to the GAO as the GAO counts them. That was actually about 2,500 resolved by the GAO in that year. And only 570 of them went to an actual decision by the GAO, where the GAO heard both arguments and decided either that the protester or the agency was correct. And so
that's about 20%, approximately, a little bit over 20%.
Yeah, I think it's about 25%, Roger. Okay. I see you're good with the numbers, too.
Yeah, I'm having a hard time there, too. So, what can you do? But speaking of numbers, right now we do have to take a break. You know, we've got to deal with those numbers there, Jack. So, but when we come back, we'll talk more to Jack Horan. Jack is a partner at McKinney Long & Aldridge, LLP, and we'll continue our discussion of recent trends and statistics with regard to bid protests. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
This is an important time for the federal government, a chance for agencies to do things differently. How will you help shape your future? Turn to Deloitte. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we'll help you rethink, reduce, and restructure, and turn resolve into results, so you can see what's possible and make it happen. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Jack Horan. Jack is a partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP, focusing on government contracting, bid protests. And Jack, when we took the break, you had just given us that, and I didn't do the math right, but about 570, in 2012, about 570 of the 2,400, 2,500 protests filed actually went to decision, so about 25% or so. I guess my next question, logical question, looking at the statistic, is how many of those protests were sustained where the protester actually won?
Right. The number, Roger, is 106, which I know this statistic is correct because I did it before we got on air.
Okay.
Is 18.6% of the protests that went to a decision. So roughly 1 in 5, I guess. The GAO found in favor of the protestor.
And that's, and I know we'll talk about corrective action too, which is an element of whether something's, I guess the effectiveness of the bid protest, and that statistic that people like to talk about. But first I'd like to get, based on your experience, just some thoughts on, in the area of protests, and we have 108. So you have 108 decisions out of 2,400 protests filed at JL where, the protester actually prevailed, and we'll add in, where corrective action, we'll talk about that in a moment, but just sort of big picture. And I guess it leads into corrective action too, because the government will look at it and say, well, I've got to fix something. But, what kind of issues or problems in procurements do you see are more likely to be potentially successful? I think some things are easier to argue than others.
Yeah, that's right. And there's also, what I would call a counterintuitive aspect to it, at least as far as some contracts.
And government contracts?
Well, what I can tell you easily what won't be successful, and that is basically saying that the agency exercised its discretion incorrectly, because the GAO has said many, many times, and the Court of Federal Claims is in the same camp, that it's not going to challenge the exercise of discretion. So what is successful are protests based on the agency not following its own rules, and that includes the regulations and statutes that apply to procurement, but most fundamentally the solicitation itself. If the agency says it's going to do something in the solicitation, or it's going to value something in some way in the solicitation, it's locked into that. And the GAO has said many times that's the playing field, and it wants the playing field to be leveled. Once the agency sets the rules, it wants it to follow the rules. And the other general category, I would say, is treating one offeror differently than other offerors. Now, we've come up with, and the GAO has come up with, legal doctrine for those two concepts.
Sure.
And the ones you see very often being successful is when the agency doesn't do a proper cost technical trade-off analysis and a best value procurement. And that goes back to the first rule, where the solicitation says it's going to be based on the best value, and then the agency's procedures don't assure a best value determination.
And that could be any number. That it could be lack of adequate documentation, right? Or to your point, in the evaluation criteria, they say the agency says it's going to value something significantly more important, but the underlying evaluation, it's, it's significantly less important just to be on the, you know, the extremes, that kind of thing.
Exactly right. Or they forget to make, they forget to consider significant technical considerations in the evaluation. And then there's a price element to that as well, where they don't conduct a proper price analysis if a price analysis is required. And then there are other procedural rules that are generally applied to assure, again, that protesters are treated evenly or treat it the same, treat it fairly. One is if you have discussions with one protester, you have to have discussions with all protesters, and those discussions have to be meaningful. So there's a whole host of areas where agencies can make a mistake that the GAO and the Court of Federal Claims has set out, and that's what lawyers like me, do for a living. The rules, or at least in my experience, the grounds are slightly different for scheduled protests, though, because of the nature of the
commercial. Okay, talk a little bit about that. That'd be great.
You have a bunch of different types of procurements, of course, and one is that we deal with regularly or commercial item procurements where the government is buying something, an item or service that's available in the commercial marketplace. You also have what are much more well-known by the public, where the government is buying something that isn't available in a commercial marketplace, like a nuclear submarine or a weapon system.
Or a tanker, let's say.
Tanker. The commercial item procurements are designed to be, and in my experience, are simpler usually than when you're buying a whole system. As a result of that, in my experience, the solicitations are usually simpler in a fashion, and the room for government error is usually less broad. So what you see in commercial item protests are, first of all, a lot more defects in the solicitation, I think, where the agency is favoring one item over another and doesn't realize it, or perhaps realizes it and wants to favor one item.
That doesn't happen, does it, Jack?
It does occasionally, Roger. And where I've seen that is an agency that is used to a particular system, not to call out a particular agency, but the VA, for example, may be used to some medical devices within the VA, and then the thought of changing to a competitor's medical device isn't attractive to some of the clinicians and even doctors there. So that does happen. What you see on the protest against the award side, because it's a commercial item, you usually have less complex technical criteria, but you sometimes see the agency not evaluating the commercial item appropriately. You see them not giving particular deference to price and determining what the best value is for the government. But less of the, I guess, highly technical mistakes you see with really complex procurements.
Sure. And, you know, I guess, the fact that the commercial item solicitations are a little more simpler and more straightforward, I mean, that's an eloquent statement in favor of, commercial item acquisitions, period, right? To me.
That was the intent, for sure.
Right, absolutely. And I know your VA was a pure hypothetical.
Yes,
situation.
It was purely
absolutely pure hypothetical. But there's another aspect the protests that I wanted to touch on, and it goes to basically the resolution, and that's corrective action. What is corrective action?
A corrective action is when the agency, after a protest is filed, decides that there are some issues with the procurement. As identified in the protest, essentially the agency recognizes that it may have made a mistake. And what the agency can do there to save everyone a lot of trouble and to save the government some money is issue a corrective action that corrects that error in some fashion or another. In those circumstances, that's why you had that large number of protests that don't go to a GAO decision. In those circumstances, the GAO doesn't have to issue a decision because the agency has made the decision itself, and they are not captured in the in the GAO protest decision statistics.
Right, but there's some sort of 42% effectiveness number. You're schooling me on this before that we started, so I have to ask you about that.
Every time you mention a statistic, Roger, I'm very impressed. But yes, the GAO also looks at what it calls the success rates of protest. And what goes into that number is the number of protests that are sustained through a decision and also the number of protests that result in corrective action on the assumption that the corrective action is favorable to the protester. And the number there for 2012 was, I think you're correct, 42% resulted in corrective of the protests decided where the GAO could make a determination resulted in a success rate, either corrective action or a sustained protest.
All right. And, right now we're back up on the next break, Jack. So we do have to take that break. But when we come back, we'll be talking more with Jack Horan. Jack is a partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP. And we'll continue our discussion amid protests. A few more questions about statistics, Jack. Yeah, I know you look forward to those.
I do.
And then we'll talk a little bit about some of the cases that that you mentioned earlier. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to Jack Horan. Jack is a partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP, focusing on government contracts. And today we're talking GAO bid protests and the stats and just trends behind it and just some of the drivers of those protests. And, when we took the break, Jack, we were talking about corrective action, but there's another thing I wanted to ask you about. And just, sometimes protesters withdraw their protests. And, what is that about? Why does that happen? I mean, sometimes I guess, the government overwhelms them, the protester, with its brilliance, I guess. But can you talk about some of the scenarios under which, protests get withdrawn?
Sure. And I haven't seen any statistics on this, Roger, what percentage are withdrawn, but it certainly happens. I think there are two primary reasons why a protest will be withdrawn. One is if the protester decides, based on the additional information provided during the protest, that it doesn't have a sustainable protest. You're faced, in my experience, as a offeror, oftentimes with a debriefing, if a debriefing is given, that doesn't provide a particularly large amount of information.
So yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
After the debriefing, the contractor, the offeror, often doesn't have any more basis for knowing why it's lost than prior to the debriefing. And my experience, debriefings are getting even more limited and the government's getting more cautious in debriefings over the last few years with the thought that the more information they provide, the more likely there's going to be a protest.
Sort of inconsistent with Mythbusters and transparency that we're talking about these days, right?
It is. Absolutely. And I won't say that some contractors, some offerors won't protest under any circumstances because I'm sure there are some out there. But I think more likely is the case where a protester doesn't have sufficient information and decides they need to protest just to obtain that information.
And, I think part of that, too, and I get your thought on this, is that, you've got a team here who has lost a procurement. And part of their responsibility is to go back and explain to their management why they lost. that's a big, impetus. And if the lack of government information or willingness to share puts them in an extremely difficult situation. They've got to be able to address that, as part of their organization, explain what happened.
That's right.
To future business decisions. It actually goes to the very viability of that particular team.
Yeah, and on the non-cynical side, I think many offerors really want to improve their proposals next time around. So if they're not sure what they're doing wrong that led to the lack of success, they want to see if they can improve that by finding out what they've done wrong.
That's a great point.
And it really has changed, at least in my experience, over the last few years, where the information, and not always, but as a general rule, is more limited coming from the government. Back to your previous question, another reason a protester may withdraw a protest is on occasion they reach a settlement, so to speak, with the winning offeror, where they maybe decide in an area of their particular strength they could get they can obtain a subcontract from the winning offeror, so the whole procurement doesn't have to be reviewed by the GAO. They're, I think, the two primary reasons.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, now let's turn to, I know there were two studies, a GAO study that you mentioned at the beginning of the show, and you also mentioned Dan Gordon's article or his analysis, and what did Dan find?
And as we mentioned earlier, as we discussed earlier, Dan was looking at a number of things, and primarily his overall goal was to find out whether, I think, protests are useful in the procurement process, and he concluded that they were based on the statistics. But one part of that that obtained a lot of attention, including press attention, was an analysis he did on the likelihood that a protester would ultimately win award of the contract that resulted from the solicitation that was being protested.
I recall that, yes, yeah.
And some would say that's the, looking at the success in the war rather than what we previously discussed, and that would be the success in the battle. If you win a protest under the GAO statistics, and then you go and ultimately lose the contract, you don't get awarded the contract, many people, I guess, would view that as winning the battle but losing the war. In my view, I think that's somewhat short-sighted because even though you may not ultimately get the contract, you've given yourself another opportunity to compete if you have a successful protest, and you're not guaranteed an award.
No matter what.
No matter what. Right, right.
So, yeah, I find that, I guess that sort of rationale a bit, it's almost like, well, is it really effective to protest or not? Or is it sends a mixed message, which I guess protests are all about mixed messages to a certain extent. But if the point is, well, if you protest, you're probably not going to get the award anyway. So is his point, why bother? Or really?
No. I was agreeing with your point. No, I think Dan's point was that, again, viewing obstruction of the procurement, that if you view obstruction of the procurement as a second choice awardee getting the award, then that happens relatively infrequently.
Okay.
But I think Dan says fairly clearly in his analysis as well, that there are benefits to the protest system that have nothing to do with who ultimately gets the award. One of them that I'll throw out there is the assurance that the government made the decision on the proper basis, even if that is the awardee's decision, because if a protest is sustained, that's called into doubt as to whether the awardee actually deserves it. But what Dan did was look at the 45 protests that were sustained in 2010 and did a closer analysis on those protests. And he determined that he could determine the ultimate result of the contract on 40 of those protests. And out of those 40, 9 of those contracts were awarded to the protester. And then one other protest, which I think was a protest related to a small business issue, the protester got a favorable result. So looking at those numbers, 10 out of the 40 known results of the sustained, the protester actually got the award, which is 25%, which I think is a fairly high number.
It's time to think about it.
Because, if you think about a typical procurement, you have 3 or 4 offerors. So even initially, your percentage, you're not guaranteed success by any means. But what happened is there was a newspaper, Washington Post, I believe, article written on it. And the reporter, probably not having dealt with these type of numbers all the time.
Sort of like Sort of, like being a lawyer. Problem with numbers, right?
Applied the wrong denominator to that. To that success in getting the ultimate contract, and concluded that only 1% of protesters actually ultimately get the contract, which is, I think, as I said, just an incorrect analysis of the numbers. My firm has looked at the numbers a different way, and I think in a relatively conservative way, and determined that if you include corrective actions and the likelihood of success in a corrective action, that overall the protester ultimately wins award of the contract approximately 12% of the time, or a little bit over 12% of the time, which I think is consistent with what we would have thought intuitively, and is also far greater than the 1% that was published newspaper.
So let's, enough statistics, okay?
Yes.
It's making my head hurt, but not you, Jack, the statistics. Let's talk a little bit about some decisions, and why don't we've got about a minute left. Can you just, sort of frame what these decisions sort of you're going to talk about in our next segment are all about? I know that's a tough challenge, but if you got a minute, can you do it?
I can do it in probably less than a minute. What I looked at, Roger, was decisions that were specific to GSA and VA schedule protests, because as we discussed earlier, they're a different type of procurement and result in a different type of protest, and tried to pick out a few of the decisions over the last year or two that I think are of significance to schedule holders who might be thinking about protests.
Okay, great. When we come back, we'll be talking more to Jack Horan. Jack is a partner at McKenna Long and Aldridge LLP, and you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
These days, it seems everyone's talking about the new normal. But federal agencies have a chance to define it. How will you shape your future? Turn to Deloitte. We understand what makes America work and how it can work better. With our private sector insight and public sector experience, we can help you rethink, reduce, and restructure, or even change the game. See how at Deloitte.com/federal. Wherever you need to go, Deloitte sees you there.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking with Jack Horan. Jack is a partner at McKenna Long and Aldridge LLP here in Washington, D.C., focusing on government contracts. And one element of that, of course, is GAO bid protests. And an element of GAO bid protests, or a subset, are protests under GSA and VA schedule orders. And Jack, I know we wanted to focus this segment on some recent cases that are of importance, and I'm just going to turn it over to you and let you start.
Okay. And as a lead into that, Roger, I would note, as we discussed earlier, that GA and schedule awards are on similar ground to any procurements, and if an offeror thinks it's been treated improperly, either in the solicitation or in the award, they can protest. But because of the nature of the commercial items, certain cases I think are more interest. And one is the Verizon Wireless case, which I think was of particular interest in the commercial items industry. And what happened there is the agency was awarding a BPA or competing for having schedule holders compete for a BPA.
A blanket purchase agreement.
Agreement under a particular schedule. And in putting together solicitation, the agency decided that it wanted to include certain terms in the BPA that would be applicable to the BPA. As most FSS schedule holders know, when the agency competes for a BPA, they can add terms that aren't inconsistent with the schedule. What happened in this situation was a protester objected to the terms that the agency was adding to the BPA, saying they were inconsistent with a commercial item procurement and inconsistent with the manner in which this commercial item was sold in the commercial marketplace, which is, I think, a clever challenge to a BPA.
You normally wouldn't think it. You're already in a commercial item type environment, right? You have commercial item contracts and schedules. So, seeing those things pop up, would be rare, you would think.
Yes, that's right. You would think it would be rare. And you would it also goes against sort of the general nature of protests, where if something is stated in a solicitation, the agency can state its needs. But the protester here decided that the agency's statements of its needs through these terms was inconsistent with a commercial item protest. I'm sorry, a commercial item procurement, which would be individual to, again, schedule holders and commercial item procurements. And what the GAO did was sustain the protest, which some were surprised by, I think, but got it right. The GAO got it right. They decided that the agency did not do market research as required by the commercial item section of FAR Part 12, I think.
Part 12 and I think Part 11 too. Part 12, yeah.
Yep, and determined that is because of that lack of market research, the protesters' challenge to these terms made sense and sustained a protest that made the agency go back and either support those terms with market research or abandon those terms. So that's a win for the good guy, so to speak, and also, in my view, a win for what commercial item procurements are supposed to be.
And that's, Jack, that is a great point, because one of the things that, you know, we talked about trends in debriefings, but there's just this growing trend in government procurement of adding additional terms and conditions that, you know, appear to be inconsistent with commercial practice in many instances. And, you know, the government in many of those instances, I think, is shooting itself in the foot because it's not getting as robust competition as it would otherwise get, as increased pricing. And there really, the cost benefit analysis between adding those unique terms versus access and competition and pricing from the commercial marketplace, I think there's been sort of the pendulum has swung to government unique requirements. So this case is kind of very nice. And so I'm glad you brought it up because it sort of points to, well, you still have to do this research when you're doing commercial item contracting.
That's right. And the other thing that's problematic about adding these terms to commercial item procurements is, as you know, Roger, your commercial item procurement is based on your FSS schedule is based on your commercial prices. And those commercial prices are based on commercial terms. So if the government then takes the baseline of the commercial prices, then adds a bunch of government-specific requirements, and here you even have a BPA, so as the BPAs work, you need to lower your price from the right. FSS schedule. So they're basically getting a commercial price with government add-ons if the GAO doesn't.
Right, so much you could argue it's outside the scope of the contract, right?
Is it?
Yeah. That's another way to look at it.
That's right.
So. Another case?
The second case I was going to talk about is a case called Diversified Collections. What happened there is a little bit different, but also a challenge against some of the terms of the solicitation. And there, the awardee objected to certain terms of the solicitation based on its understanding that the solicitation would permit objection to some of the terms of the solicitation. And the protester then challenged that award, saying that the award was improper because the awardee wasn't accepting all of the terms of the solicitation, which goes back to the unlevel playing field, I think.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. And it also put into, and again, this was awarded under an FSS schedule, so it also put into play the general principle that an award under an FSS contract can't have inconsistent terms with the FSS schedule. What the GAO said there, specifically referencing the FAR section on commercial items, was that although the protester initially objected or appeared to object to the terms of the solicitation, ultimately they accepted the terms of the condition solicitation, which was consistent with, and I think it's FAR 52.212-4, which permits something that an order that's awarded under a FSS to have additional terms that aren't consistent with the FSS.
Sure.
So there, the protest was helpful in providing the GAO's view on the flexibility of agencies in awarding orders under an FSS schedule without being inconsistent with the FSS schedule, without becoming inconsistent with the FSS.
Right, sort of. It goes almost to that scope issue I just mentioned. Like, what? How far can you go in adding terms and conditions?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Next decision?
The next one is Quest. Again, a GAO decision. And what's interesting there is Quest challenged the solicitation as not being clear in the evaluation terms, which, as I noted before, is a pretty standard challenge to a solicitation, and one that the GAO has a number of times said is a valid challenge, that the agency has discretion, but it has to make its requirements clear in the solicitation. The protest was not sustained. The GAO came out in favor of the agency here. And why I find it interesting is the GAO noted that it was a commercial item procurement and appeared to suggest in the decision that because it was a commercial item procurement, the agency's description of its needs was sufficient. Didn't quite say it, but there seems to be implied in the decision that the agency can be less rigorous in describing its requirements when it's purchasing a commercial item because of the nature of the commercial item.
Right. So, I mean, I'm thinking, I need a car. Okay. Yeah. You could get a Honda, or you could get a Mercedes, or you could get, I don't know, a Ford, whatever, you know, just across the board, right?
Right.
I mean, they may have different features, I guess. So, that's interesting. That actually, I think that actually speaks well of commercial item contracting as well.
Yeah, I think it is. It's consistent with commercial items contracting. What causes concern for me as someone who does bid protests is the far extent that the GAO will go if they're going to follow that process and allowing the agencies to be less than clear on their needs. But I agree with you that if you're buying a car, you probably don't have to say every detail on how a car works.
Sure. And I think you have one more decision you want to talk about?
I do, if we have time.
Yeah, we've got about a minute left.
So. Okay, I'll make it real quick. It's the Kingdomware decision. And there, it's interesting for a couple reasons. But ultimately, what GAO originally said that was that when a VA does a set-aside under an FSS, it has to use the rule of two, which is a typical rule in set-asides that the agency has to determine that it'll have at least two offerors before they set it aside. The VA decided the GAO was wrong on that, which is very rare, and decided not to follow the corrective action by
that
the
is GAO. Rare, because they have to write to Congress and all that stuff, right?
Yes.
Explain it, yeah.
And the issue finally went to the Court of Federal Claims, and the Court of Federal Claims came out the other way and said the rule of two doesn't apply.
Does not apply. Schedule. So they said GAO was wrong.
The GAO was wrong, which is interesting in itself. But what occurred after that is GAO has now said they won't consider protests on those grounds because it has its view and the agency won't follow it. So it's just going to be not a permissible grounds for GAO protests.
Huh. Interesting. That is interesting. So I'll give you 30 seconds. Can you, sum those cases up? What's the big message there?
Yeah, the big message, I think, is that there are some differences between schedule item procurements and, as a result, protests. But that a offeror should understand that if they think the solicitation is unfair or improper, or that the award was unfair and improper, that protest is very viable even for those types of procurements, that those differences can be navigated, and the GAO and the Court of Federal Claims still provide a forum for those challenges to be addressed.
Great. Thanks, Jack. And I want to thank my guest, Jack Horan. Jack is a partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP, here in Washington, D.C. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.